This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword.
This podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Welcome to the Sword and Laser, episode number 75. I'm Veronica Belmont.
Hey, everybody. I'm Tom Merritt. Welcome. We don't have an audience this time. I kind of like that.
Oh, I know. That was so much fun last week. Wasn't it?
It was. And Robert J. Sawyer was a great guest. And
yes.
All the people in costume and the people not in costume and the people buying t-shirts and the people not buying t-shirts were all awesome.
Mm-hmm. And in case you haven't listened to the show before, we are, of course, referencing our live episode that we had last week at Dragon Con in Atlanta. And oh, my God, the fruit fly is back. I have a fruit fly haunting me in the office. Ah, it's in my face again. This is going to be bad.
This is going to be a recurring theme throughout Sword and Laser.
Until he meets his demise.
Normally, we do not have recurring themes, but, you know, this is a literature podcast, so
yeah,
why
I have
not?
A feeling we're going to be doing some callbacks to this particular instance throughout
the
show.
There might even have just been foreshadowing.
For a later incident. In which I kill the fruit fly.
Exactly.
But anyway, yes, this is a show where we talk about our favorite sci-fi fantasy books, talk about what's coming up in the world of sci-fi fantasy, talk about TV shows, books, movies, video games, anything that kind of relates to the genres.
Centered around the book club that is Sword and Laser, but branching beyond it, stretching our limbs.
And the first part of our show, as always, is the Quick Burns.
Like we said, the newest news. And so we have a book review from 1915. The book review is from September 11th, 2011. It's on blogcritics.org. But it's a review of The Man Who Found Zero, Early Science Fiction and Weird Fantasy from The Black Cat, which was a publication from 1896 through 1915. There's some pretty cool sci-fi stories in this compilation.
Yeah, actually, the digest came out from 1895 to 1920, and then they did a revival in 1922. But it is like kind of some of the freakiest sci-fi fantasy stuff, mostly sci-fi, that I think I've ever even read about in my life. I mean, this is early stuff. So what I love is that all the ideas are so new in a lot of ways.
Yeah, everything old is new again, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody has done these in a while, and so it feels unfamiliar and therefore new to us. For instance, The Transposition of Stomachs is a story by Charles Mixer. We find a self-described gourmet with a delicate constitution who proposes to a longshoreman acquaintance who's of enormous girth that they trade stomachs. And when this works, the longshoreman then goes into business for himself, exchanging stomachs with everyone who has the money.
I love even just calling him a longshoreman. Like, you don't get that kind of terminology these days.
You don't get that too much anymore.
It's very, according to the reviewer, very Twilight Zone-esque in its feel.
Yeah, I think probably the Twilight Zone was still just enough in touch with this era of science fiction to have a little bit of that element. But I have not checked it out, but this review fascinated me, so I may be picking this up.
We need that. We need a reboot of the Twilight Zone. Didn't they try to do that?
They did. Yeah, well, there was the movie,
work,
right?
Yeah. Was there?
There was the movie, and then there was also the I want to say that they did another TV show run, but
I feel like they did that with
The Outer Limits.
Oh, you're right. Well, if anyone out there knows,
some sort of vast collection of information at our fingertips that would tell us.
All right, I'm clicking away. You talk about the next thing, and I'm going to look up the Twilight Zone.
I was looking it up too. Lost Classics aired in 1994. They had a first revival in 1985, because he sold his share of the series back to the network. And there was a second revival. Apparently UPN attempted a new version in 2002 that did not last.
Okay, the narration provided by Forest Whitaker and the music by Jonathan Davis of the rock group Korn.
Yeah.
That was very much a hunk of time there.
Ah, yes. Yes, indeedy. All right. Meanwhile, in our very present, a former editor of Punk Planet called Dan Sinker had made some name for himself on the Twitters by being a fake Rahm Emanuel. He Twittered under the name Mayor Emanuel and had a story to his posts. It wasn't just like straight ahead mocking. He had a little storyline. So now, starting tomorrow, twittering under the Twitter ID HuffPostBooks as part of the Huffington Post, he is going to Twitter a short story. When I say tomorrow, I mean September 13th.
Hold on. I've almost got this fly in my grasp.
Hopefully, about a fruit fly. You know, some people
want to Obama this fly and just like grab him out of the air with like a chopstick.
Veronica has a fruit fly.
Okay.
So anyway, he wanted to write a short story about books, about mythology, and about why we hold the stories inside them so dear. So he is going to attempt using the feedback of the audience. He said he's got some beats he wants to hit along the way, but he's going to take in the suggestions and the at replies as he goes. So if you're listening to this after September 13th, then go ahead and go back to HuffPost Books and check it out, and you can see the results.
That sounds pretty awesome. I'm gonna have to go back and watch that. Watch it happen. I mean, tomorrow.
Yeah.
In the future.
In real time.
Sorry, I'm so distracted by this fruit fly. It's like a worst case scenario. It keeps like flying like right at my face.
Does the fruit fly have special powers or attributes, or is it just a run of the mill fruit fly?
I don't think they even bite. So even if he did.
Why is it bothering you so much then?
Because it's in my field of vision, and he keeps trying to land on my wine glass. And that's a problem.
Well, that's insulting.
That's a problem.
That is a big problem.
Anyway, we should move on to the calendar. Coming out on the 13th of this month, September, The Night Circus by Aaron Morgenstern. And I was actually kind of disappointed because I saw Morgenstern and I thought maybe it was Morgenstern. Yeah. I was like, nope, not the same person.
Not that Morgenstern. This is actually
different person.
Morgenstern, who exists.
His daughter, yeah. The circus arrives without warning, but behind the scenes, a fierce competition is underway. A duel between two young magicians, Celia and Marco, who have been trained since childhood expressly for this purpose by their mercurial instructors. Unbeknownst to them, this is a game in which only one can be left standing, and the circus is but a stage for a remarkable battle of imagination and will. Despite themselves, however, Celia and Marco tumble headfirst into love. Deep, magical love that makes the lights flicker and the room grow warm whenever they so much as brush hands.
September 13th is a big, big day. A lot of books coming out this week. Prospero Regained by L. Jaggi Lamplighter. Prospero and his family survived centuries beyond Shakespeare and now protect humanity from a multitude of supernatural threats. You probably know that from the previous books in the series. But now he's trapped in hell. Oops. And Miranda is working furiously to reunite her warring siblings to spring him out.
Also on the 13th, Highest Frontier by Joan Slonkowetsky. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly. Slonkowetsky.
Yeah.
Well,
Joan S.
From Tor, published by Tor. The Earth has been ravaged by climate change and other human-made catastrophes, and Jennifer Ramos Kennedy's brother was among the victims when New York City's seawalls collapsed. But she's among the troubled world's best and brightest.
So this is like Harry Potter in space?
Apparently. So she's a freshman at Frontera College, a prestigious, well-funded institution located in orbit around the planet. She just wants passing grades and something resembling a social life, but as a budding botanist, she'll find herself drafted in the fight against an invasion of an alien species.
You know, Joan S. probably would like stab me through the heart for hearing me say Harry Potter in space.
Well, you know, that's how they pitched it.
It does sound like Harry Potter. We are not out of September 13th yet. How Firm a Foundation by David Weber, also out that day. Weber's fifth Safehold novel takes you back to the Carizian Empire, where Emperor Caleb, Empress Charlian, Merlin Athrawes, and a lot of other people that I can't pronounce are still fighting to protect their place in the universe. Of course, they're outnumbered, but they're going to have to take the fight to the Church of God anyway. Mm. We'll see if they survive. You're going to have to check out the book to find out.
And on the 15th, we've got War in Heaven by Gavin Smith, the sequel to last year's strong debut novel, Veteran.
And finally, from the rest of this week, September 15th, sees Briar Patch by Tim Pratt. Darren's girlfriend dumps him. His life falls apart. 6 months later, he watches his ex take a suicidal jump off a bridge, but is more than a run of really, really bad luck. In his struggle to figure out why she did this, Darren encounters all manner of weirdness, including the Briar Patch, which is a bit of extra metaphysical space in the universe. And he hopes if he goes in there, maybe he'll find Bridget. But if not, at least he'll find some answers.
Now, on the 20th is one that we've a lot of people have been waiting for. Reamed by Neal Stephenson.
I think it's called Read Me.
Read Me.
I heard
Me.
Some idiot on Sword and Laser
called
it
Read Me.txt.
Jeez.
Did we read the description for this one before? I feel like we haven't.
No. Yeah, let's give it a good... Because I'm excited about this.
Me too.
Neal Stephenson book.
I think I already pre-ordered it. But anyway, Richard Forthrast has parlayed a small fortune built on pot smuggling into a massive one, building a wildly popular MMORPG called Terrain. Or Train. It's spelled like T apostrophe rain.
Yeah,
train,
it's like the Spock way of spelling
Terrain. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very Vulcan.
Of course, any wildly popular online platform immediately attracts criminal attention, and so a group of Chinese hackers builds a devastating virus called Reamed, which locks every file on a user's computer, and they demand a ransom.
I demand a ransom.
This creates all kinds of problems, especially for one Terrain programmer named Zula, who's kidnapped and thrown in the back of a jet and finds herself bouncing from questionable bunch to questionable bunch. The official HarperCollins announcement calls Reamed Stevenson's most accessible novel to date, but mostly it just sounds like a crackerjack but brilliant thriller.
You know, this has some of the hallmarks of a good Neal Stephenson novel. You got a virtual world, you know, you got a crime, you got an unexplained group. All of that fits. But the whole bouncing from place to place, for some reason, and I know there's a lot of bouncing to place in Cryptonomicon and such, mm-hmm. It really sounds like it might be a little William Gibson in there.
You know, I was thinking the same thing. And yeah. Maybe it's because there's a female main character. It kind of reminds me a little bit of some of Gibson's work, for sure. But we'll
also
see.
Yeah, I'm excited. So also September 20th, Goliath by Scott Westerfield. It's the Dieselpunk trilogy concluding. The Leviathan is headed for New York City with Alex still struggling to regain his rightful position as Austrian Archduke. Damn it. And Darren still working to keep her gender under wraps. Can they navigate the geopolitical mess that is the 1910s? Can they hash out their feelings? Also, Nikola Tesla apparently shows up in the book.
Interesting.
And I love a Nikola Tesla appearance, as witnessed by my love of the show Sanctuary on the Sci-Fi Network.
There you go. On the 22nd as well, we have, or actually on the 22nd, the first one coming out on the 22nd is The Islanders by Christopher Priest. Priest's first novel in almost a decade. This novel returns to the Dream Archipelago, the setting of the titular short story collection and The Affirmation, one of his finest novels. The Islanders is it's a pretty good book, and The Separation, I think, is the next one? I'm confused by this description.
The predecessor, The Separation. So The Separation was the one before The Islanders.
Okay, yeah.
September 27th is going to see three big books. I'm just going to run through all three of these real quick because we have so many in the calendar today. Ganymede by Cherie Priest. We'll talk about it again before the 27th.
Is she related to Christopher Priest?
I don't think so.
Interesting. But
there's a sub apparently parked at the bottom of Lake Pontchartrain. So... It's all southerny, Louisiana-y. Sounds good. The Hum and the Shiver by Alex Bledsoe. East Tennessee family with fairies. Gotta like that. And The Immorality Engine by George Mann, Victorian special agent, Sir Maurice Newberry. You can take it from there and pretty much feel it out. Also, an indomitable assistant named Miss Veronica Hobbs.
Miss Veronica.
Hobbs,
like
even.
All right, well, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor. This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many of the New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you the chance to try out their service. And I have been listening lately to Soulless by Gail Carriger.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah. It's great. And it's funny that we mentioned another Victorian era novel, yep, previously, The Immorality Engine, because Solas is very much in that time as well. And the main character is just phenomenal. And it's very, it's fun. It's kind of steampunk. It's kind of sexy. And it's been a very enjoyable listen so far. It's narrated by Emily Gray, and she does a great job with all the voices in the book.
So that is just one possible free audiobook that mm-hmm. you could get of the many, many thousands of choices. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sword, and sign up for the free trial, you get a free audiobook, yours to keep whether you sign up for the service or not. It's just a way for you to try it out. And by the way, if you're already an audiobook listener, already an Audible member, you can pass that URL around to your friends. Audiblepodcast.com/sword will work whether they listen to the show or not.
Right? You know what I'm saying? Okay?
You know, just do a friend a solid here.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have been reading a book lately. Of course, we spoke to Robert J. Sawyer in the last episode, he being the author of Flash Forward, which is the book that we've been reading lately.
And that fruit fly still in your wine?
No, he's in my face again. You may have heard me clapping earlier to try to...
I was going to ask if the fruit fly had drank all your wine, or if you had.
I did, which is why I cannot pronounce lately. we just finished... you and I have both finished Flash Forward at this point.
And when I say just finished, I mean, just finished.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I finished
like
it
today?
An hour ago.
Really?
Yeah. I had it timed out perfectly. Like, I was listening to it on the drive home. Mm-hmm. And when I pulled the car into the driveway, I had 9 minutes left on the entire book.
Did you just sit in the car and listen?
No, I came on inside and then just, and I'm doing my little routine of taking off my coat, I didn't have a mm-hmm. coat on, but you know what I mean. Taking off my shoes, all that stuff. I just listened to
your
the last
little
9 minutes.
Mr. Rogers neighborhood.
Yes, when routine. I changed into my tennis shoes and my sweater.
You put on your cardigan.
Fed the dogs.
Aw.
All that stuff. So it's very fresh in my mind, but I think we should hold our thoughts until the end because we have some great thoughts about it from our Goodreads forum.
Excellent. Up first today is a thread started by Anne. About the foreign language issues within the book. Now, she said, I just finished Flash Forward today and was positively surprised at how different it was from the TV show. Not because I didn't like the show, but because I didn't read a story I already knew. However, I had some issues with the way the author handled the non-English, specifically the German language parts of the story. I guess he wanted it to sound more authentic by adding the multinational aspect, but it's always a tricky field, and I was slightly annoyed by how it was done in this case.
This is interesting, yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, it's a very long post, but we'll get to some of the major points. It may contain mild spoilers, but nothing really that serious. She says, two of the German characters introduced are called Helmut and Wolfgang.
Helmut and Wolfgang.
Helmut. More than that, the one... Am I saying that right? It is Helmut, right?
Helmut. Helmut. Helmut is fine for English speakers like you and I.
All right. It's supposed to be a young boy in 2009. Now, while Helmut and Wolfgang are very typical German names, but at the same time, they're also pretty old-fashioned, and I wouldn't expect anyone of my generation to be named that way. It feels completely out of place. I get that there are some explanations as to the young Helmut having the same name as his father, and I'm not completely sure about the names being given in more southern parts of Germany, as well as Switzerland or Austria, but the general feeling is that these names that are chosen, they're chosen that way because they sound so very German, but at the same time they somehow make it sound a bit lazy.
Now she goes on in the same vein saying the nickname Moot doesn't seem to be a plausible German nickname, although mm-hmm. it is, you know, Geneva and a different world and maybe a little more international. She also says that using the word Jawohl, mm-hmm. not ironically, sounds a little odd to her. And then there was the German word for mom and a few other examples like that. So in other words, someone who speaks German and knows German very well, looks at this and goes, that doesn't strike me right. And so a lot of the thread was about the response to that and whether the author should have done more research or did he do enough research? Did he travel there? Robert J. Sawyer does a lot of research. At least he described quite a bit of research that he does for his books. Mm-hmm. But he may have in 1999, used some old research. What if as part of his research in 1999, remember, I think a lot of people forgot how old this book is. When he wrote it in 1999, maybe he, drew upon some older research that said, oh yeah, Wolfgang and Helmut, very common names. Or maybe he just went by Germans that he knew that maybe were around his own age or older, and they were named Wolfgang and Helmut, and you wouldn't name them that. You know, there's not that many people named Tom anymore, even though Tom was at one point a very common name. So I could see how that sort of thing is going to take Anne out of the story, but probably not bother anybody who doesn't know any better. It's a tricky business, though, when you write outside of your comfort zone or don't really know that you're outside of your comfort zone.
Yeah, and then even Terp Kristen had a comment about the discussion of physics in the book and how a lot of the scientists were speaking in a way that was more like book talking instead of conversational talking.
Yeah, that was a really interesting point, because at first she just said like the physics struck me as a foreign language that wasn't properly understood. So I asked her what she meant by that, and she said it wasn't that it was wrong or incorrect, it just didn't sound natural. And she's like, in fact, it didn't sound arrogant enough. Kristen knows some physicists.
I agree, but I also disagree, because there was actually one moment in the book where they call another researcher from North America, and they have a discussion. I don't want to give too much away, but they have discussion about a possible explanation for the phenomena. And that conversation seemed very, very conversational, almost to the point where the other scientist that they called was saying things like, yeah, blah, 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 blah. Like, just felt very the way I would talk to someone else in my industry. You know, yeah. So I agree with on some points. Maybe that happened more often than not in the book, but I think he did do a good job sometimes of making it feel very natural.
I felt like there were portions when he decided to explain the physics that it did come off like a not a textbook, but a nonfiction book where they would explain, like when he explains transactional interpretation of Schrodinger's cat, which I was unfamiliar with. That was a really interesting part. But I did feel like suddenly I was reading, you know, a nonfiction book like Chaos by Michael Gleick. It didn't necessarily ruin the fiction for me, but it did take me out of the voice for a little bit. But I'm also willing to forgive that in a lot of places, because being too natural could be confusing.
Yeah.
Because if you're natural, you're going to assume that you're talking to other physicists who understand a lot of what you're saying, and the audience may not.
It's a very fine balance, because obviously not all of us are Terp Kristen and understand the physics of what's actually being discussed. And so we need that explanation. And sometimes you need to go, you know, pretty in depth with explaining what's actually happening. That's hard to make conversational.
Yeah.
And when you think about it in the context of two scientists talking to each other, I mean, obviously there's going to be some assumptions there based on what they know, and we don't have that base knowledge. So they have to go that extra step to explain it no matter what, because otherwise we're going to be like, what the hell is going on?
Especially when you're trying to base it on real physics and you're not just, you know, 1,000 years in the future and making stuff up.
Like, I feel like I actually learned a lot reading this book, which was pretty cool. And even after talking to Robert J. Sawyer, we need like an acronym for him.
RJ?
RJ, RJS.
RJS.
Even after talking to old RJS, JS.
Well, Rob. He's okay being called Rob in person.
Okay. So even when we talked to Rob, it felt like, you know, the science was very secure. There was a lot of research that went into it, and I wanted to learn more about what was being discussed. And I feel grateful that he went to those lengths to explain it, and I didn't feel like the conversations were taking me out of it, because I didn't know what the hell they were talking about.
Yeah.
So I needed that extra time to kind of think about the theories and the discussions that they were having.
Now, similar to the problem of maybe a location not sounding quite accurate, or the physics talk not sounding quite natural, Vladimir posted a discussion about the future tech. He said, does anyone else think that a bunch of tech that's described is completely unrealistic in 20 years? I don't think we'll have any hover cars by that time, nor the weird self-mutilation of having transparent skin. I mean, it's already 2011, and we still don't have Windows 2009 three-dimensional desktops. This sort of thing bothers me in a book that's meant to portray a sort of realistic world with all real countries, institutions, etc. Is it only me, or does this bother anyone else? And then he has a paragraph about what he thinks about hover cars particularly. But what do you think? I mean, there were some folks who came down on his side and had other examples, but then some folks said, no, wait a minute. This book is actually, you know, it gets some stuff wrong, but it gets some stuff right, too.
Yeah, it didn't bother me either. I thought it was kind of fun, actually, to hear about what he imagined the technology to be at this point and in 20 years from now.
And again, remember, he's writing this in 1999. So the transparent skin was actually supposed to happen in 2009. He got that wrong. But there are some other things that he got right. He actually got he put the African-American president of the United States too far in the future. We got that before he thought we would. Uh-huh. He correctly predicts the name of the next pope, Benedict XVI.
That was weird, right?
That was, you know,
is that predetermined? Or
I read that part and just went right past it thinking like, oh, yeah, Benedict XVI. And then
when we interviewed him,
he mentioned, he's like, yeah, I got lucky with that one. He just made a good analysis of what the names have been picked in the past. The popes generally pick names that have already been picked. Mm-hmm. John Paul was very unique in picking the previous two names. So you could figure, well, it's not going to be John. It's not going to be Paul. What else could fit in here that would go with the times? So he made a great selection there. And I think we forget that a lot of the stuff in 2009 that maybe we just kind of gloss over was not real. Mobile computing was not real in 1999. So some of the stuff in there just kind of flips by, you know, that like they have tablet computers described in the 2009 of this book. Tablets were not catching on in 1999. No. So that was a prediction, which if you had read this in 2002, you would have said, well, he got that one wrong. And then it turns out, no, as a matter of fact, he got it right again.
I like the car technology. And I think that maybe in 20 years, we will actually be at that point where we can just tell our car to circle the block a few times looking for parking.
Oh, they are. No.
I hope that is the case.
This goes back to Vladimir's point. Does anyone think the tech described is completely unrealistic? I do not agree that the tech described is completely unrealistic.
No.
And maybe Vladimir just phrased it too extremely. I think it's reasonable to believe that hover cars could be invented and could be a necessity. I don't think they will. I don't think it's probable. Let's put it that way. But I don't think it's unreasonable. It's an interesting guess.
Sandy goes on to say, I'm 50 and I was told in elementary school that we'd have hover cars and cars that would run for 1,000 years on a cup of nuclear fuel by 2000. I haven't seen it yet. Yeah. I'm only up to chapter 9. I think what got me about the tech was how the characters were using videotape in 2009. We did have DVDs by 1999 when the book was published, didn't we? Couldn't we have foreseen digital recording devices for video?
Am I inventing this in my head, or was there an explanation that this equipment was old and that it was odd that they were still using it?
I feel like maybe that was the only thing they had left at CERN.
Yeah.
But I don't really remember.
Because there are still security systems to this day in 2011 that use videotape.
Oh, definitely. That's
what was installed.
And then she goes on to say, even more jarring than the tech is the fashion. In 2009, a salmon jacket is the height of fashion for a 40-year-old man, and no one under 30 wears jeans that are blue, only bright colors. A page boy is the trendiest male hairstyle. Really? Actually, I think that was the female hairstyle. I think that his
I thought that was a female hairstyle.
No, too. I think his Japanese wife, whose name is escaping me right now.
Michiko
was actually the one who had the page boy hairstyle. And that makes sense.
Yeah.
Fiance.
All right. Then one last thread to get to was from Josh Lawrence. Determinism versus free will. Now, I jumped into this forum and had a good time discussing it with people, and it's very thick. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we should necessarily read all of the discussions here. If you really want to get into this, this is a great thread to discuss determinism versus free will. But it is definitely the theme. Robert Sawyer said that in the interview. He's like, yeah, this is a story about whether we have free will. And Robert Sawyer said, I believe we do have free will.
Mm-hmm. So Josh goes on to say in the thread, he says, I remember in college being very disturbed when I first came across the question of how free will could exist in our apparently deterministic physical universe. For a short while, I thought chaos theory provided a way out until I realized that chaotic systems, though unpredictable in the long term, are still entirely deterministic. I was in humanities instead of sciences, or I would have realized that sooner. Maybe the bizarre wonderland of quantum physics could offer some backdoor to free will, especially since there seems to be a variety of interpretations, i.e. no consensus, of how micro-quantum physics relates to our macro-level day-to-day Newtonian-Einstein physics world. he goes on from there. And people have very interesting responses. But you're right, it is a massive thread already in the making.
So what is your take on this, Veronica? Have you given this much thought? Based on this thread, do you come? Because I make clear in the thread where I come down, and I'll make that clear on the podcast too. But I wanted to give you a shot to go first.
You know, Hold on. I think I got it.
Is that fly? It was
determined to die tonight. Let me tell you that right now. Anyway, I'll come back to the, you. Will be the death of me, fly, or I will be the death of you. Anyway, my gut tells me, and this is totally outside of any kind of, you know, religion or any kind of feelings in that matter, because I do not hold those feelings, but I do have a sense that things are predetermined.
Ah, really? Okay, interesting.
That is like my gut feeling. Mm-hmm. And I don't really have a good explanation of why, but I have always had a sense that fate kind of controls my life. You know, it would be nice to think that we have free will, but I don't know if I feel that way deep down.
I have some psychologist friends, Dave the psychologist, long-time listener to podcasts I do, and I like his podcast as well, flat out says we do not have free will. The idea of free will is laughable. Mm-hmm. And he is not the only person who is a professor of psychology to hold that belief. But he doesn't believe that therefore we are fated to, you know, be determined. It doesn't necessarily mean we have determinism, right? Mm-hmm. It's that there is a series of events that are going to lead to things. When I think of it, I think of it from the quantum mechanics side, which is with quantum mechanics, you do not talk about a ball, you know, traveling from point A to point B. You talk about the probability of which path it will take.
Right.
Now, in practice, that ends up being the same thing as saying it'll go from point A to point B. But you have to think about it in quantum mechanics as probabilities. And I think that's probably where free will can creep in, which is to say that, yes, there are probabilities and the most probable outcomes are going to happen. And you could see that as determinism. But in fact, nothing in the universe is totally determined. And so we may not have free will the way an absolute definition would define it, but we have the perception of free will and choices we make do matter and do change. Mm-hmm. And so it almost becomes a philosophical question of whether we have free will or not. That is academic. As long as we feel like we have free will, and as long as we have the ability to make choices, and as long as those choices can lead to the demise of a fruit fly.
Which just happened.
I figured from the cackling glee, that it almost doesn't matter whether we actually have free will or not. I mean, there's all these studies that show like when we determine to take an action, the brain is already sending the signal to take that action before we realize we have decided. And so, you know, that's usually held up as an example of, oh, so you don't have free will. But the other question that goes along with this is, can you change the future? You know, and that's a whole different question because we don't really know if we can know the future. But if we could we change it? And I would always go with the multiple worlds theory saying, well, there are multiple possible worlds. Every action causes, you know, a branching. And so, yeah, we could see the future of one reality and then pop over to another. But then, of course, he brings up the transactional interpretation of Schrodinger's cat and blows that all to hell. Then turns around later in the book and says, aha, but that's exactly what happened. So, yeah.
You know, it's difficult because I've always kind of gone on that whole every decision you make branches out into a totally new, you know, universe, basically. But it just seems too complicated. It just seems like that. Maybe that's where my like lack of free will feelings are coming in, where I'm like, yeah, I understand how every time you make a decision, holy shit, there's another fruit fly. Oh my God. My house is being taken over. Pardon my French. What was I saying?
You were saying that maybe you feel that there is no free will because of multiple worlds.
The multiple worlds theory I have always found very interesting, and that seems to explain a lot, but then I feel as though for some reason that is too complicated, and therefore I backtrack to the lack of free will to kind of explain the fact that perhaps our futures are predestined and fate does have an effect, and therefore there's no need for these multidimensional universes.
Well, then I'm going to go all Nick Bostrom and say, you know what? There's a high probability that we are living in a simulation. You know, it may not be.
Oh, God, not 50, this one.
Maybe not be greater than 50%, but.
Sorry, oh, you know, flying spaghetti monster.
There's roughly a 20% chance. And therefore, if we get to that point,
that where does this 20% chance come from?
From Nick Bostrom.
That's actually like the percentage chance that we are living in a simulation
like a
right now.
It's not like a highly precise calculation. It's a rough thing.
All right.
He explains why in other quarters. But I'm going to combine that with the omega point where we get the ability to simulate every single life that ever could exist all at once. We get the computing power to do that. And all of a sudden, you have multiple worlds. You have every version of Veronica Belmont that could have ever existed, making every decision that Veronica Belmont ever could have made. And therefore, you have multiple worlds and every decision is made. And therefore, when you make a decision, you're choosing a path. So you, as a subjective perception along this track, have free will because you can choose which path you're going to follow through that multiple worlds.
So but I'm like an entity traveling throughout my various.
Yeah.
Dimensions.
But from out, your consciousness is. But from outside, all of those paths
that
exist.
That is awesome.
And so you don't have free will objectively, but you do subjectively.
I love that. Okay, that's my new belief. I like that one. That's cool.
Yeah.
And in my reality, every time I kill a fruit fly, two more spring up in its place.
Yeah, apparently. I've noticed that lately.
Dude, what's that worst. About? It is the worst.
Overall, ooh. Wrapping up, what do you think of Flash Forward?
I really liked it. I read a lot of people saying that they didn't connect with the characters. I didn't feel that way, actually. I really enjoyed all the characters in the book, and I did feel invested in their histories and in their decisions. I thought the science was very, very interesting. I especially liked that it was so based in fact, that this really felt like one of the most hard sci-fi books that we've probably read.
Yeah.
I would put it above and beyond, a Blind Sight or I don't know. What else have we read that's hard sci-fi? Science fictional universe, not really so much.
Yeah, we haven't read all that much hard sci-fi. That's been one of the reasons people have been crying out for that. So,
but
yeah,
to compare to his contemporary who wrote Blind Sight, I feel like this was much more rooted in actual science and much more rooted in a world that I could foresee occurring.
Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Meh, yeah, okay.
Could arguably be considered hard sci-fi. Ender's Game, yeah, but neither one are like the hardest of sci-fis.
Well, both Blind Sight and this novel attempted to explain the science behind what was going on. Mm-hmm. I found this science much more believable and factual with my limited understanding than Blind Sight was. Maybe it's the vampires. Who knows?
Yeah, don't bring up that old thing again.
That old trope.
Maybe it was. I really liked the book. I thought it was extremely thought-provoking, and that's what I want out of science fiction. And so it's a success for me right there. I did feel like it was a quick jump, like a sudden jump, when we ended the 2009 storyline and went to 2030. I felt that was a little abrupt. I'm not sure how I would fix that, but I kind of wanted a softer transition there. And I missed Lloyd Simcoe in the first part of the jump forward to 2030. But it did get a little Arthur C. Clarke with the whole look for the second jump forward from 2030. Not as unexplainable as 2001 A Space Odyssey with Star Baby and whatnot. But it was close and almost would rather have the Jade Man been left unexplained instead of being revealed. That almost ruined the mystery for me.
I kind of liked that reveal, actually. I thought it makes sense. And the decision that he makes therein, I think, was very, very nice. A good tie-up.
And I like how Robert J. Sawyer does not hit you over the head with things. It was very obvious what decision he made. He didn't have to explain. And it's almost better to not explain it because Lloyd Simcoe doesn't even know that he made that decision.
Oh, yeah. Good point. The Theo storyline I found to be interesting, if perhaps a little exhausting at times. I was kind of done with that story. I was kind of hoping he was just going to let it go. But then the realization of all of the like what actually went down at the time, I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, we did get a nice action adventure novel there right at the end. Yeah, that was pretty fun.
So it had all the elements of many different kinds of books, and I think he tied them together very well. I mean, we had the hard sci-fi, we had a little bit of action adventure, we had some of the more esoteric like theories in terms of our possible future.
Even
and
a
what
touch
it could
of
hold.
Romance.
A little bit of romance, a little bit of mystery. I think it brought everything very nicely together, and it was a relatively short read, and I think it kept the pacing up very well.
I agree. Let's finish up with some TV and movies news from Goodreads.
Yeah, so World War Z, which of course we've read from Max Brooks, is filming right now in Glasgow, and Nick actually linked to a BBC article from Scotland. Parts of Glasgow were being turned into the war-torn ruins of Philadelphia as filming gets underway for the Hollywood film of World War Z, of course starring Brad Pitt.
A lot of controversy over the script and the explained plot and how it might just be more of a thriller and less of an oral history and not capturing the book. We'll have to see about that. But pretty cool that there's some people in Glasgow who can report back from the set. Pickle, for instance, says he walked past at 1 a.m. on August 25th. He doesn't own a mobile since he lost his third phone. He's not allowed one. So no pics. But not much to see other than a taxi crushed by a bin lorry, which is kind of a trash type truck. So
why are they filming way out there and not in Philadelphia?
You know, why do they film in Vancouver for New York? It's just wherever they can get the best deal. And someone in the thread suspected maybe they need access to lots of climates at once. And Glasgow, you know, has microclimates kind of like San Francisco. So they can get rain, fog and all kinds of things.
Yes, many people are concerned about this adaptation. Many people in the forums, many people including me,
many people in the world.
Blogosphere.
Yeah,
we'll see how that goes. And then there was another thread started by Kevin, and he is looking for other players of Star Wars The Old Republic.
Oh, I'm so pre-ordered. Yep.
If you're getting ready to set down some time in Star Wars The Old Republic, let Kevin know in this thread, because he's looking for friends. Of course, he got jealous because we were talking about WoW stuff in a recent episode. And Tom and I, of course, belong to the Alia Iacta Est Gaming Guild, which, of course, spans World of Warcraft, Rift, and many other games. We also play a lot of games with each other in Xbox Live and PSN. So if anyone is interested in learning more about that, head over to aie-guild.org, and you'll find all the ways that you can hang out with us on the gaming nets.
Time now to bear your sword. And by that, I mean read some emails.
This first one comes from Jim in Boston. He says, "Hi, Tom and Veronica. Hey, where do you get the info for the calendar segment you have? Is it a website? I looked on Goodreads and I didn't see anything related to that. This would be a useful site to bookmark. Thanks."
The calendar segment in Sword and Laser violates one of my main principles of podcasting, which is don't do anything that's really hard. I actually go out and research to find the elements of the calendar. I use io9.com, which is very good about posting up seasonal and often month at a time looks at books that are coming ahead. In fact, we get a lot of the descriptions of the books from io9. Bestsellers.about.com has general new and upcoming releases. Sometimes I'll find some stuff there. sfsite.com also has their new books section. The Wort Zone has a yearly look ahead at books. And so for the first part of this year, I use that. That starts to become less useful as the year gets older. And I used to go to Borders. But of course, now that they're bankrupt, I can't really rely on them. But I've now found that BarnesandNoble.com has an excellent section of upcoming releases, and you can drill down by genre and see just the sci-fi stuff. So that's pretty helpful as well.
You know, maybe we should make a public Google Calendar and just add in all the things that we find for our calendar.
Yeah, you know what? I could just take that calendar tab that we use in our prep lineup and copy that into a public Google Doc.
Yeah, that might be fun.
That'd be great. Yeah,
we'll work on that for next week.
And stuff. That'd be good.
And then the next email comes from Nicholas. He says, "Hi, Tom and Veronica. I recently downloaded the .mobi version of United Moon Colonies from archive.org and was saddened by the formatting. The .mobi file kept all the United Moon Colonies headers and page number from the original file. The problem is that they must have treated as plain text when the original file was converted into .mobi.
Yeah, it was converted by archive.org automatically. Ah. So the .mobi and the other versions that aren't .txt are kind of not optimal.
Well, to any extent, he fixed your book.
Thank you.
And sent us the files.
That's awesome.
So maybe we can put them on the website. Are you cool with that? Or do you want to keep everything
on
archive?
Totally. I have it on my to-do list to take those files and put them up on the web and link to them from unitedmooncolonies.squarespace.com, which is where I'm collecting everything, and replace those archive.org links. So thank you, Nicholas. That was fantastic of you to do. I really appreciate it.
That's why
you Creative Commons stuff. So Nicholas doesn't sit there going, well, I'd like to do this and share it with people, but it's actually a violation of copyright. No, Creative Commons means, Nicholas, you can do that, you can publish it, and you can pass it along to other people without any worry. That's the kind of thing that it's meant to do. So
woo-hoo.
Awesome.
All right, now it's time for some new member hellos. Do we want to go back and forth again?
Yeah, why not?
All right, I'll start. Hello to Matt.
Zenfi.
Mitch.
John.
Armando.
Mark.
Crather.
Judy.
Cynthia.
Jenny.
Kevin.
George.
David.
Roy.
Carlos.
Steven.
Paolo.
Andrew.
Officer Friendly.
Officer Friendly. Heather.
And Mike. Welcome to the forums, welcome to the podcast and the show, and hopefully you'll get lots of enjoyment out of our discussions and everything going on in the forums.
Bienvenidos.
Bienvenidos al sword and laser. I don't know how to say sword or laser in Spanish, so...
No, but the name is in English, so you just keep it. You
know. If anyone wants to send me an MP3 of them saying sword and laser in Spanish, en español...
En español.
I would be mucho happy.
You'd say gracias to them.
I'd say gracias to you. All right, if you want to get in touch with us, the email address is theswordandlaser@gmail.com. The website is swordandlaser.com, and you can follow all of our discussions over on goodreads.com or click the discussion tab from the website. All right, guys, we will see you next time.
Thanks, everybody.